1 Corinthians 7, if you're using a pew Bible, it can be found on page 955. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourself to prayer, but then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am. But each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single, as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a bondservant when called? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a bondservant is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when called is a bondservant of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants of men. So, brothers, in whatever condition each was called, there let him remain with God. Now, concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. And those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it, for the present form of this world is passing away. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord, But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, and has determined this in his heart, to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So then he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is. And I think the two have the Spirit of God.
So you probably noticed that chapters 5, 6, and 7 of 1 Corinthians are, generally speaking, about sex. We give the 1960s a little too much credit. Humans have always wrestled with issues of sexual intimacy, and the Bible is full of great failure. Last week, I think we read from Psalm 51, David's exploitation of Bathsheba. The Bible also addresses sex very positively, and so if you've ever read the Song of Songs, great book of the Bible. Sex is an issue for every human in every year since the creation of the world. But we don't live in every year, we live in this year, and this year there is a gross misunderstanding about the role and the setting, the context of sex. On college campuses throughout the country, girls and boys buy into the hookup culture, where sex is regarded as casual, emotionless, and a mark of maturity. And sadly, many think that unless they hook up, something is terribly wrong with them. And yet, there are chinks in the armor of this hookup culture, so students aren't actually out there feeling empowered and freer and wiser and more mature because they engage in casual sex. And this isn't wishful thinking from a pastor who's supposed to say things like that. Donna Freitas has done research on campuses throughout the country. And she discovered something very interesting about this so-called hookup culture. And so Freitas put it this way, this brave new world is making very few people, men or women, gay or straight, happy. So students, in other words, might be telling their peers, their friends, how great this hookup culture is. But privately, they long for relationships that are intimate and serious and personal and meaningful. And there's a word for what they long for. Marriage. So whatever your background, whether you're an atheist or an agnostic or a seeker, Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 7 are worthy of careful study. There is a time-tested alternative to the reckless social behavior that has become the norm in our hypersexualized culture. And for the Christian, whether you are 18 or 88, God has a message for you in this chapter. God understands the demands and the difficulties of marriage, and he knows the stresses and strains of singleness. And so wherever you are on that spectrum, right, 1 Corinthians 7 is for you. Sexual confusion is going to persist until Jesus comes back. But if our church is going to last, and if we're going to be a refuge of peace and wisdom and purity in an ocean of sexual chaos, then we need the wisdom of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So today, we're going to see how an enduring church is thankful for marriage, thankful for singleness, and thankful for the sovereignty of God. And in fact, that's the outline. Thankful for marriage, point number one. Thankful for singleness, point number two, and thankful for the sovereignty of God, point number three. So number one, thankful for marriage. Now verse one is important. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. Now that term sexual relations has been translated in many different ways. Verse 1 literally reads, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. So separate. Right. Now this statement is in quotes because Paul is summarizing the viewpoint of the Corinthian church. Just as some argued it was okay to be intimate with a prostitute, right, chapter 6, others were arguing that we must reject casual sex, chapter 7. They rejected using people as objects of mere sexual pleasure. And that's in context what it means to not touch a woman. So Paul is not saying, you know, it is good simply to not be intimate with a woman. That's not his point. That term to touch in its context is saying basically, you know, casual sex is wrong. Now, of course, that's what the Corinthians were saying, at least some of them. And Paul agrees with that. But he wants to go on and affirm that sex is not dirty, that sex is good when enjoyed in its proper context, its proper setting, the lifelong union of a man and a woman. And so this is why, at least one reason why, we can be thankful for marriage. But specifically, Paul goes on to show us that we can be thankful for three things in particular. First, the pleasure of marriage. Look at verse 2. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Some of you are thinking, you know, I've been in church for 25 years just waiting for this passage to be preached on. This is admittedly the most candid description of marital intimacy in the New Testament. Again, Song of Songs. But one thing that really jumps off the page is the Bible's view of women. We read in Genesis 2 that a husband and wife are one flesh. And then Paul here in 1 Corinthians 7 says that a wife belongs to her husband and a husband belongs to his wife. Right, the husband has authority over the wife, but in this context, the wife has authority over the husband. So yes, husbands and wives have different roles in marriage. Wives are called to submit to their husbands, but Paul is very clear. Mutual submission takes place in the bedroom. Each spouse is called by God to attend to and be thoughtful about the physical needs and desires of the other. And intimacy, Paul says, isn't only for having children, as some in the history of the church have taught. Intimacy is a place where a husband and a wife can both satisfy and please and care for the other. And that's why Paul says a spouse has certain conjugal rights. Right? This means that a spouse is obligated, obliged to take care of you physically, to please you. And in fact, it's wrong for your spouse to deprive you. So I found it so interesting how one commentator noticed that in our culture, cheating, when you hear the word cheating, you think of adultery. And that's wrong, and it's in the Bible, and it's wrong. But cheating for Paul, in this context, happens when a husband or wife deprives his or her spouse of sex. Now, there are times when intimacy isn't realistic. Of course, we've got to be careful how we live these verses out. You know, after a long day of work, whether it's outside the home or inside the home, physical intimacy can seem more like, well, work than pleasure. And yet, Paul gives only one reason for a husband and wife to abstain in verse 5, prayer. There are moments in marriage where it's right for a husband and wife to fast from intimacy and to pray. Otherwise, intimacy should be frequent. Now, how often this happens? And how you can be prepared to give and receive? Well, these are conversations every couple needs to have together. And so I'm moving on. my married brothers and sisters, take the Bible seriously. Intimacy is something you should plan for and prepare for. You are not supposed to allow the trials of life to push intimacy out of the marriage bed. This is not complicated theology. I know that marriages are complicated. I've been married for 21 years. I get that. But this is clear. It's not right to let weeks go by without being close in this way. Remember, the goal is not your pleasure, but the pleasure of your spouse. So, husband, you belong to your wife, and wife, you belong to your husband. So we can be thankful for the pleasure of marriage, but also for the protection of marriage. Notice how verse 5 ends. After this time where husband and wife are not intimate because they've been fasting from intimacy to pray, right? All you married people I know can relate. After that, Paul says, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Come together again so that you won't be tempted by Satan. So the meaning is clear. When you go an extended time without connecting with your spouse, physically and emotionally, you're opening a door for temptation and sin. Now, certainly this is true when it comes to physical intimacy, just the mere mechanics of it all. But it's easier to battle lust if you can anticipate being with your spouse soon. But consider this. What happens in the marriage bed is more than physical. So last week, I referred to sex as a mystical union. All right, maybe not the best word. All I mean is that there is a close and intimate and even a transcendent supernatural bond that forms with sex. And a husband and a wife who are regularly together and selflessly pursuing this union, well, they will find their physical and emotional needs met. They will be less tempted, therefore, to bond with other people or with other images. So marriage, and specifically intimacy in marriage, is God's protection against sin and temptation. Now, I'll talk a few minutes from now about how this truth affects singles, but for now, let's just notice one more thing that we can be thankful for in marriage, besides the pleasure and besides the protection, but the permanence of marriage. Look again at verse 10. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. Now, Paul says at the beginning there, not I, but the Lord. And it's not that Paul lacks the authority to deliver a word from God. And we've been going through 1 Corinthians, and we know that very clearly. Paul is an authoritative apostle, a messenger of God. But Paul here is simply pointing out that this statement about the permanence of marriage comes directly from the public ministry of Jesus, who taught in Mark chapter 10, verse 11, who taught in Luke chapter 16, verse 18. Jesus taught that marriage is for life. So what Paul is saying here is nothing new. That's his point. So in Corinth back then, and in Atlanta today, there are admittedly husbands and wives who feel like they're done with marriage. They're tired of fighting, just tired of arguing, afraid of the damage that's being done to the kids. And some consider marriage a prison from which they want to break free from, to escape from. They want out. Well, brothers and sisters, before we even talk about exceptions, we need to let this truth sink in. You know, marriage is for life. You know, Dean and I were very young believers when we were married, and somehow this teaching sunk in that divorce is not an option. That's what, by God's grace, we told one another. I'm glad that we did, because year 7 was hard for us. I wasn't easy to live with. Can you believe that?
No way.
Get out of here. There were ways that, you know, I was caught up in my own life, my own thoughts, my own ambitions, and I pushed Dean away. But we knew divorce wasn't an option, and by God's grace, we persevered. Now, if you're divorced, this can be hard to hear. And I do believe that there are exceptions to this prohibition against divorce. One is in verse 15, where Paul writes, "But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved." So here Paul says, if your unbelieving spouse abandons you, you are not enslaved. I take that to mean you're free to divorce and remarry. The other exception is one that Paul really doesn't address here, but Jesus does in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9, where Jesus says that sexual immorality may make divorce permissible. I don't think it means every act of porneia does, but Jesus seems to allow for an exception. So, were you abandoned? Did you suffer with a spouse engaged perpetually in sexual immorality? Right, before anyone concludes that these exceptions are for them, they should seek godly counsel. This is one reason God gave us elders. There are men in the church that God has raised up to be elders who are going to be especially held accountable to God for what they say about the Bible. It's those people to whom we should go and talk to about some of these thorny questions about how the Bible applies to your particular marriage. Go to them for wisdom. Just because you've been wronged doesn't mean divorce is inevitable, but sometimes it's allowable. And in such cases, Paul and Jesus would say divorce is no sin. But some of you look back on your divorce with regret. Right? You know it was wrong. You are now convinced that there were no biblical grounds for divorce in your case. You know that in your case it was not biblically permissible. And if that's you, remember, this is why you need Christ. If reconciliation is no longer possible, and if reconciliation is possible, go for it. Pursue reconciliation. But if it's no longer possible, then all you can do is repent of your sin. Trust in Christ and realize that this is why he suffered and died. Salvation is not some abstract idea. Right? It is salvation from our sin. Salvation for the judgment that our sin deserves. And so if you know that you sinned in a previous marriage, go to the Lord. This is why you need him. Go to him. Now back to Corinth. This was a very young church. It was barely 4 years old when Paul wrote back to them, full of baby Christians with lots of questions. And many of these Christians in the church in Corinth had come to Christ. They'd been converted. They'd become believers after marriage. And in a lot of instances, the husband and the wife did not both become Christians, which is why some had unconverted spouses. And because of the way sex was viewed in Roman society, many of these unconverted spouses and converted spouses would not have been sexually moral or pure. What should Christians do? Well, Jesus didn't address that situation directly, which is why Paul says in verse 12, "To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. Wife, how do you know whether you will save your husband? Husband, how do you know whether you will save your wife?" So isn't this amazing counsel? Do you see what Paul's doing? He's saying, look, be patient. You know, if your unbelieving wife or husband will stick it out with you, so should you. Live with them. And don't think your marriage is somehow second class. You know, your he's writing to the believer here, your Christian presence in your family makes everyone holy. It makes the unbelieving spouse holy. It makes the children holy. It's not that you can save your spouse. It's not that you can save your kids, but you're near to them, right? When you're around them, they get to hear the gospel. When you're around them, they get to see something of the gospel at work. And who knows? You know, maybe one day your faithful witness may lead to the salvation of your husband or the salvation of your wife or implied the salvation of your children. Be a peacemaker, Paul says. Be a peacemaker. I want you to live at peace, not meaning get a divorce so you won't have any trials. I want you to live at peace. You know, pursue this marriage that it might be saved and grow and flourish. And maybe even one day your unbelieving spouse might come to know the Lord. So brother or sister, is your husband or wife an unbeliever? Don't give up on them. Keep praying. And don't feel uncomfortable here at church. You don't need to. Our church is full of all sorts of families with all sorts of messy problems. We are not here. None of us is here because our families are perfect. We're here. We're all here because Jesus is perfect. We're called to live at peace, and this means being peacemakers in our families, working hard so that whenever possible, by God's grace, according to his great word, our marriage will be permanent. Brothers and sisters, marriage is something to be thankful for. We are not prudes when it comes to sex. Just look at 1 Corinthians 7. God gave us the capacity for intense physical pleasure. But we believe with Paul, and we believe with Jesus, and we believe with basically every book of the Bible, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 2, that the only appropriate setting is a lifelong union between a man and a woman. And we are thankful for the protection that marriage affords in the battle against lust. Right? What a kind and gracious God. For those who are in marriages, God has given you protection against lust. Utilize it. And we're thankful for the permanence of marriage. In a culture that treats people like cars, right, something to replace when they get old and dented, the Christian is to treat his or her spouse like fine wine. Can I say that at church? Fine wine, something to be prized more and more with every passing year. An enduring church is thankful for marriage. It's not all Paul writes about. An enduring church is thankful for singleness. For as much as I said about marriage, what really stands out is Paul's attitude towards singleness. Paul is thoroughly convinced of the inherent goodness of being a single Christian. Now, first, notice singleness is not for everyone. Notice verse 6. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am. But each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, it's hard not to read this and think married people are losers with no self-control. I don't think that's the case. Marriage is good, but God gives some this unique gift of singleness. It seems as if Paul is saying that at least for a season, God gives some this gift of singleness, the way some might have the gift of evangelism or others might have the gift of administration, right? The Spirit works unusually in the lives of some so that they're able to conquer sexual temptation, and the Spirit helps them uniquely and powerfully and joyfully serve Christ and his church. So I don't think Paul is saying, well, some of you have the gift of marriage and some of you have the gift of singleness. He might be saying that, but I don't think so. I think he's understanding that most people are going to get married, that you're just sitting there burning with lust, and he gets that. But he says, to some, he uniquely gifts with this Spirit-given ability to be single for the glory of God. And it's a wonderful, unique gift of God, and he gets all the praise and all the glory for it. All may not have this gift. But Paul says it's good when you can be single, and he does not hide his preference in verse 7. I wish that all were as I myself am. So Paul commends singleness as a great gift from a gracious God. And then he proceeds to give two reasons to pursue singleness. Reason number one, your circumstances. Look at verse 25. Now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you from that. Now look at verse 25. The ESV uses the word betrothed in verse 25. That's someone who's engaged, right? Paul definitely talks about those who are engaged in verse 36. But many of you will have a little footnote next to betrothed, and in the bottom it might say virgins. So here I think that word, so often translated betrothed, because of the larger context, probably simply means those who have never been married. So the virgins or the unmarried might be a better translation there. In any event, Paul already made it clear in verse 7 that it's better to be single. But in verse 26, he refers to the present distress as a reason for singleness. Now, scholars debate what this present distress is. Some argue, mainly because of verses 29 through 31, which appear to be talking about the end times and the last days and the importance of living for Jesus. You know, regardless of what's going on in your life, live for Jesus because we're in the last days. Because of that, a lot of people say the present distress is really the fact that Jesus is coming soon, so don't pursue a spouse. But others argue that this present distress was really a situation particular to the city of Corinth, or at least that area, an economic crisis, maybe a famine. And under such a distress, it would have been financially difficult to have a family, and this would be a reason to remain single for a time. I think that's probably right, that the present distress is a particular crisis in Corinth that would have made supporting a family hard. And so Paul hopes to spare some people from the worldly troubles associated with trying to support a family under these grave economic circumstances. The pressure to make ends meet can be so intense that marriage may best be delayed. You know, it's hard for us in the West, and in circumstances like most of us have, to appreciate this as a reason to be single or to pursue singleness. And we should be careful not to establish some standard of economic security that is so high, you put marriage off year after year, like, okay, when I get that down payment for a house, then I'm ready to get married. Or, you know, when I get that promotion, then I'm ready to get married, right? Even in the midst of the economic crisis, Paul says it's no sin to get married. He says so in verse 28. So if it's just beans and rice, and sometimes not even that, Paul says it's no sin to get married. Right? Those struggling to pursue holiness, in fact, regardless of your economic circumstances, should get married. But nonetheless, there is something to be said for a man being ready for marriage, having a job, and being able to support a family. And if your circumstances are distressing, you may, for a season, need to pursue singleness. And so that's one reason for singleness. Circumstances. But here's another reason to pursue singleness. Not just your circumstances, but your Christ, your Messiah. And this is Paul's chief argument for singleness. Look at verse 32. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. So Paul says marriage is full of certain anxieties, certain concerns. His use of anxiety here is not to be confused with a sin. It's not sinful to have these kinds of anxieties or these kinds of concerns. They're just real limitations to being married. When you're married, your time is not your own. It belongs to your spouse. Verse 33, a married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. And the reverse is true. Verse 34, the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husbands. Just think how stronger our marriages would be if every day the husband asked his wife, how can I please you today? And the wife asked her husband, no, how can I please you? Whether they ask the question or not, married couples have to deal with this. You know, whose house will we be at for Thanksgiving? Are you feeling neglected this week? Who's going to put the kiddos down tonight? None of this is bad. It's just the necessary nitty-gritty details of married life. But Paul says there's another way. Look again at verse 32. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. So Paul is convinced that to remain single is a good thing so you can serve Christ. That's really, really good. Look at verse 35. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. Paul is so clear. Singleness is a benefit to you. Undivided devotion to the Lord is better than divided devotion to the Lord. Paul applies this principle to the engaged in verses 32 to 35. It's fine, he says, to marry the person you're engaged to. And yet, look at the end of verse 38. He who refrains from marriage will do even better. And if you're a widow or a widower, Paul has a word for you. You're free to be married. You're free to remarry, but Paul says you'd be happier if you didn't. No offense to any of you who've married a widow or a widower. Verse 40. Yet in my judgment, she is happier. She remains as she is, and I think that I too have the Spirit of God. Friends, let me just say something so countercultural, okay? But here it is, I think pretty clear. I didn't even need to go to seminary to say what I'm about to say. Friends, a celibate, single life is glorious. There it is. It's better even than marriage because you can be fully devoted to Christ. You have the freedom to constantly serve the Lord. Paul loves being free to serve, and he wants you to be free to serve too. And even if you aren't single forever, your singleness for however long you have it is a unique opportunity to pour out your life for Christ, to serve him and to serve his people. The hookup culture isn't making single people happy. It's having the opposite effect. What does make people happy? Undivided devotion to Christ. My single friends, don't think less of yourselves because you're single. Remember Paul's exhortation here. God has given you a unique opportunity to be of service to Christ and his church. I know you can feel like a second-class citizen at times, like you don't completely belong or that you haven't completely arrived, but that's not true. However you got to be single, whether it's because you simply never married or because of a divorce or because you lost your spouse, you have an equal seat at the table of the household of God. And I know there are sometimes things that churches do that maybe give the impression that that's not the case. For example, why is this sermon entitled Thankful for Marriage and not Thankful for Singleness? I don't know. Talk to the pastor. Brothers and sisters, use your time wisely. Spend time with non-Christian friends. Find a discipling relationship. Consider the mission field. Don't take the time you would spend with a spouse and simply devote it to yourself. No, devote it to Christ. Now, to my married friends, don't encourage singles to think less of themselves because they aren't married. You do this if you constantly go up to them and ask, have you thought about this guy? Or, have you thought about her? She's adorable. I'll never forget being at a college retreat and having dinner with the main speaker, and a young lady in her late 20s was there at the table, and she started to talk about dating and marriage, looking to get pearls of wisdom from the conference speaker, who looked at her and said, 29, time to shine. Had this guy not read the Bible? 1 Corinthians 7, maybe? Right, consider carefully how you interact with singles. Are you leaving them with the impression that they're really great now, but they'd just be a little bit greater if they got married and had kids? Encourage instead singles to use their singleness for the glory of God. Commend them when you see them serving. Invite them into your home and let them minister to you as they share all the ways God is using them to serve the church and to serve Christ. Right? Invite singles into your home. Some singles struggle with loneliness. Not all of them, but some do. And your family can be an answer to their prayers. And if you do think someone would be a good match for a single you know, pray before you speak. Ask yourself, why do I think this person would be a good match? And only after you've prayed and talked in your own mind about why you think this person would be a good match, only after you've done that should then perhaps you thoughtfully go up to that individual and tell them about your great idea. Tell them if the Lord would have them marry, you think it would be wise for them to consider a person like this. for these particular reasons. Flippant comments about the married state of singles made as they're walking out the door are not helpful. Mount Vernon, we are not a congregation of families. We are a family. There is no kids' table for the singles. We all have a seat at the feast. So let's be careful in our attitudes and our actions not to privilege the married over the unmarried. An enduring church is thankful for singleness. Third and finally, an enduring church is thankful for the sovereignty of God. Now, some of you, as I mentioned before, are in marriages that are really, really hard. You love your spouse. You want to be married, kind of. But some days you wonder if you're going to make it. You're overwhelmed by the demands of married life. And married life just seems to magnify your weaknesses, and you're just kind of tired of your weaknesses being magnified. Or maybe, truth be told, your spouse is really hard to live with. I know he might be right next to you right now. No one knows but you, right? And what about singles? Maybe you know you don't have the gift of singleness. You pray that God would help you to be content, to be free from the burning passions of lust, to be free from the pain of loneliness, but every day is a trial. You want marriage, but the girls just don't respond or the guys just don't ask. Friends, if something there has just struck a chord with you, you should seek counsel. God has given you a church. We love and care for you. We want to serve you in your marriage and in your singleness. You don't have to bear this burden alone. You shouldn't walk through this valley by yourself. This is why God has given you the church. But in the midst of your trial, there is a theological truth you need to cling to. It is no coincidence that in this very chapter on marriage and singleness is a tremendous reminder of the sovereignty of God. Look at verse 17. Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Everywhere I go, Paul says, this is what I preach. Where has God put you? That's where you are. Be okay with it. Your place in life is no accident. God has assigned it to you. He has called you to it. God was not asleep on the day you got married. And he's not out playing golf as you struggle with singleness. He has assigned to you your place. He has called you to your position. Now, does this mean you should never change your position? In verse 21, Paul actually encourages slaves or bondservants to get their freedom if they can. There are times when there is abuse in marriage or when separation therefore must take place, and singles burning with passion should strive for marriage. But what do you do when you can't move? What do you do when you're stuck? And that's what verse 17 is for. All right, Paul reminds us that whatever our circumstances, we can trust God is not asleep at the wheel. He has us where he wants us. Like a soldier in battle, we are at our appointed post. God hasn't abandoned us, far from it. His hand is on us right where we are. And so often when Christians struggle, they think, well, what did I do wrong? You know, but isn't it possible that you are where you are, not because of what you did wrong, but because of what you did right? Isn't that what, like, the whole book of Job is about? Right? I'm not sure anyone had it harder than Job, but God didn't allow Satan free reign in Job's life because of Job's sin, but rather because of Job's righteousness. What does the Bible call Job? Blameless and fearing God. Blameless and upright, fearing God and shunning evil. And yet, Job suffered. What you need to remember in the midst of your pain is that God is with you in your suffering. Just think of the gospel. Jesus Christ knew no sin. There wasn't a single day in his life when he gave into idolatry or sexual morality or greed. He was absolutely pure. And yet his Father appointed him to suffer and die on a cross. And through his death, the floodgates of salvation have been opened up for sinners like us, so that everyone who'd ever come to God through Jesus Christ would be saved. God appointed his Son. He called his Son to that cross. And the Father, who loves you, has appointed you to a cross. I cannot be sure why God has appointed you to that place, but this much I know. He's put you there for a reason, and you can be content because God is sovereign. Brothers and sisters, listen to the words of A.W. Pink, who wrote, "Divine sovereignty is not the sovereignty of a tyrannical despot, but the exercised pleasure of one who is infinitely wise and good. Because God is infinitely wise, he cannot err. And because he is infinitely righteous, he will not do wrong. Once I realize that God wills only that which is good, my heart is made to rejoice." So, brothers and sisters, I do pray that you love your marriage. And I pray that you are so content in your singleness. But brothers and sisters, you can be more than content in your marriage or in your singleness. You can rejoice because you can trust that God has called you to that place. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you that your word seems to touch on every aspect of our lives, from our marriages to our desire for marriage, to singleness to our desire for singleness. You have a word for it all, and we thank you for that. We praise you that you are a God who is not sovereign over some things, but sovereign over all things. And because of that, we know we don't need to change our position. We can stay exactly where we are. We thank you that that's the choice that Jesus made, not to run from you, not to flee from the cross, but because it was your will, and for the joy set before him, to endure the pain and the suffering for our good. We love you, and we pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.